Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep, and when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience, because Purple mattresses are made with a GelFlex grid. The GelFlex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips, and support in others, like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the GelFlex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines GelFlex grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect Purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
It's time for Pitch Hit and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Give the kids in your community a chance to flex their superpowers, and they could earn a trip to the national finals of the 2025 World Series presented by Capital One. So go ahead, be the one who powers their dreams, and sign up to host the local Pitch Hit and Run event. It's a free and fun way to promote baseball, softball, and your organization. To learn more, go to pitchhitrun.com.
Welcome back. Drew Hill filling in for Jeff Calkins on 92.9. I now welcome on Dan Devine. He is the senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, host of the No Cap Room and Devine Intervention podcast. He is on Twitter at YourManDevine. And yes, I still call it Twitter. Dan, first question, and maybe I could figure this out for myself, but why do we have to wait a week for the NBA Finals to start? This is ridiculous.
I'm considering it a personal favor to me. I like to look at the league's decision making in terms of its structure, in terms of, like, can you get like a couple nights off so that you can help around the house a little more? Can you get like a couple nights off to watch some DVR with the wife? Abbott Elementary has just been piling up, so stuff like that. I feel like that's why the NBA does it. I do not know the answer to that question. I think that it primarily winds up being like, we want to get big prime time night Thursday, Sunday, you know, we can get a lot of eyes on the product, but then you wind up with a Sunday night like this past Sunday where there wasn't anything, and you go, so it does seem like we could have launched there, but I think the idea, if the upshot is you wind up with the rosters as healthy and fresh and, you know, ready for action as possible to put the best possible product on the floor, I guess we'll all be happy come Thursday night, but yeah, it does feel like the waiting is the hardest part to this point.
Yeah, I wonder, and I'm not, obviously, TV matters a lot more than this, but I also do wonder from a fan perspective, if you're anticipating that your team may be in the finals and you want to go, to know the dates ahead of time, to know when you need a hotel booked, I guess that would help. But we do have
I think that's a big thing. Like at the beginning of every summer, they say, like, you know, here are the key dates for the year ahead. And they've already got, like, these are our days. We got the arenas locked down. We've got we don't know which cities it's going to be in. But we know for our broadcast inventory and then also for what the travel is going to need to be for our personnel and for everybody that needs to get in and out of there, this is when we need to book it. So I think there's that part. It's like you got to put a foundation somewhere before you can fill in all the blanks. And these particular foundations have been set up for a long time, but now, I don't know that anybody. I think Boston was something that probably people had their spots booked a while ago. Dallas, I'm not so sure about, though. That one kind of came out of nowhere the last couple of months, but certainly well deserved for the Dallas Mavericks.
It really did, and I mean, we nearly had the Stars in the Stanley Cup final too. That would have been scheduling those two things around each other would have been total chaos for Dallas. All right, well, we have a finals matchup. It is the Celtics and the Dallas Mavericks from the bird's eye view here. What do you take away? What stands out to you about this particular matchup?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, like, I'm fascinated in just finding out what Kristaps Porzingis looks like if he's there for game one. I mean, by all accounts, he's, you know, been doing 5-on-5. He's like has not played for the Celtics since the middle of that first round series against Miami, strained his calf. By the time game one tips off, I believe it will have been 39 days since he was last in an NBA game. Well, welcome back, buddy. You're in the finals, and Luka is going to start working out switches to see if you can go guard on the perimeter, how that leg's feeling, if you can move those puppies. Also, the, you know, oh, by the way, you were supposed to be the guy that got Luka here. That didn't work out so hot. Then you got traded. You got sent off to Washington, you know, NBA Siberia, before the Celtics came in and scooped you up. And he looked for all the world like the biggest missing piece. Like, he is the guy who can stretch the floor. He makes the five-out offense work. He's a great rim protector at 7'3". Oh, he also is the somebody who, when everybody starts switching all the assignments on the perimeter with all the Celtics wings, we can dump it down to him in the post. Well, he's the answer there because he can shoot over the mismatch. He's gotten better at posting up, which was something that Rick Carlisle famously was like, we don't have him do that because he's not good at it and it's not an efficient NBA play. He's gotten so much better at it over the years to the point where it is a real antidote to some of those switching defenses. So he looms to me as a huge X factor in this series and also just an interesting emotional character. But I think the biggest thing is going to be Luka Doncic has... he's put himself on the precipice here. Like, we do this every year, but because there's so much elite talent at the top of the league now, where, you know, 3 years ago it's Giannis, then it's Jokic, and now Luka is in the position where if he goes ahead and he has knocked off the number one seed in the West, the number one defense in the NBA, if they go ahead and knock off the number one team, the 64-win Celtics, historic net rating and margin of victory and all that stuff, and he goes off like he's been going off in that, he's going to have an awful lot of support for the idea that he's the best player in the world right now. And, you know, he's put himself in that position with the series that he's had, the way he's played, even through a knee sprain, which I think we forget about. He has been absolutely lights out, and it's been incredible to watch. And if he goes and takes another team's heart on the road to a championship, you know, we got to start having some different conversations about where guys line up.
What Dirk did in 2011 for that Mavericks team was so impressive, just because the finals win was over the Miami team that obviously ruled that era. What Luka has the potential to do here would be more impressive, correct? Just because of the state of the roster, or less impressive because of the opponents?
That's an interesting question. I think the reason we remember Dirk's run in that 2011 playoffs so fondly is there was no other superstar player alongside him. Right now, that team fit him like a glove. There was Tyson Chandler, as you know, he wound up, I think, the next year, Tyson Chandler's in New York and he wins Defensive Player of the Year. But you know, Tyson Chandler was a perfect fit defensive anchor for that team, much like you got the tag team now with Daniel Gafford and Derek Lively II. But that team, it was Jason Kidd long in the tooth. There was Jason Terry, not quite an all-star. There was J.J. Barea as a spark plug off the bench. You know, there were good players up and down that roster, but there was no other number two that's near the level of what Kyrie Irving has been, not just in this postseason, but throughout the regular season when he's been healthy. And I think that was one of the big sort of pivot points for their year. Everybody goes back to the trade deadline, and understandably so, as they bring in Daniel Gafford and they bring in P.J. Washington. They shuffle up their starting lineup there. They reorient on the fly, and they sort of develop a new identity. A big part of that, though, was early in the season, Kyrie was hurt, and he had missed a significant chunk of time earlier in the season, which was, that was part of the book, right? It was, I mean, there were a million other reasons why folks were saying that they were, you know, maybe needed to have their heads examined for making that trade to bring Kyrie Irving in at the 2023 trade deadline. But part of it was he hasn't played a full season in God knows how long, and hasn't been consistently healthy in God knows how long. When he is healthy, he is an absolutely perfect number two, a guy who can be that all-NBA caliber shot creator and shot maker, but who has evolved into someone comfortable with playing that second banana role that he's, you know, sometimes bristled at in Cleveland. So there was nobody like that on those Mavericks teams, the Mavericks team in 2011. And I think that's why, you know, it's Dirk against the world, right? Everybody else is clicking up and crewing up, and then Dirk goes out there with a team of, like, good role players, but he's the guy, and he goes out there and he takes each and every one of them down. I don't know that we would necessarily remember Luka's run the same way, but I mean, I think, yeah, you sort of stack it up and just say you can only play against who's available to play against, right? And if he goes out and he knocks off the number one seed, and you know, the Thunder are a young team, yada yada, but they were there for a reason. They were damn good this year. Take them down. Take down the best defense in the NBA, and take down the number one overall seed, a 64-win team that had, you know, has been in the finals twice in the last 3 years, has been in the conference finals six of the last 8 years, like a really legitimately good top-to-bottom team that everybody's been saying since October, that's the best starting lineup in the league, it's the best top six in the league, yada, yada, yada. It would be an awfully impressive road, I think, even if, you know, you don't necessarily stack it up you know, against maybe some of the elite teams. He hasn't had to quite play them. But given who was in front of him, who was on the docket, you know, certainly a pretty impressive performance all the way around.
Let's put yourself in the future 1 week from now. How much discussion will there be about Boston as a whole's treatment of Kyrie Irving? Like, will we be talking about, oh, man, they were so brutal on Kyrie, it went a little bit too far even? Like, put yourself in the future 1 week from now. Are we talking about that as a storyline?
I mean, I honestly, I would be surprised if we weren't. I think, like, the dynamics are, I mean, it's raw nerves and hectic emotions sort of all over the place. I know my colleague Jake Fisher had wrote a story about the kind of the narrative arcs intertwining here with Kyrie going back to Boston and Kristaps going back to Dallas and the way things have sort of moved since their tenures in their respective spots. I mean, but there was nowhere near the level of venom and vitriol surrounding the Porzingis situation in Dallas as there was surrounding Kyrie's situation in Boston. And I mean, I don't know. I said this on No Cap Room on last week's episode. I feel like I almost don't know how to talk about that time in Kyrie's career, because I think you can zoom out from it and say, this is a guy who, you know, through one lens, it's he dynamited a situation in Cleveland that was absolutely perfect and tailor-made for him, right? He moves his way out of there because he wants to be the number one guy. He wants to have his own team. He doesn't want to be under the auspices of LeBron. And maybe he also sees reads the tea leaves and sees the writing on the wall that LeBron might be leaving in a couple of years anyway. So he just wants to get ahead of it. But you can understand a guy being like 25 years old and saying, I've already made the All-Star teams. I've already won a championship. I've already hit one of the biggest shots in NBA history. I'm not getting any of the credit for it. And I want to see if I can learn how to, I want to run my own shop. I want to see what it's like being the number one guy. And then to do it with Boston, with the history of that organization, with the passion of that fan base and the intensity of it, to be somebody who maybe sometimes just says stuff where you're like, at one point it's, I'd love to be back here if you'd have me. I want to be a Celtic for as long as possible. I want my jersey up in the rafters with the rest of those greats. And then 4 months later, it's, I don't know anybody, bleep, and I got to do what's best for me. And again, when you're 25, 26, things can change pretty quickly. So it went nuts. It was hectic. There was stomping of leprechauns after while he was in Brooklyn. And then
incense.
Knows.
Incense. We had that too.
Yep, yeah, the burning of sage to dispel you know, negative energies that had accumulated there. There's been a lot with Kyrie Irving. There sort of always is, and that's been, I think, the biggest wow aspect of his performance in Dallas. It's been specifically recently, but you go back to last February, and I mean, there is nobody who's got a bad word to say about the way he has comported himself in Dallas and the way he has sort of sublimated himself to the structure. You know, he understands he's the number two beneath Luka. He's the guy who's going to spell Luka and try to drive Luka, but it's not his show. He gets that, and he's on board for it. So, like, the issue here is, like, I feel like you're going to see the Dallas version of Kyrie is almost like what you would have hoped to get if you were the Celtics from Kyrie at that point in his life. But, you know, yeah, the roads that we travel get us where we need to go, and he's in Dallas now performing at that level, and I think that the Boston fans are not going to be particularly sympathetic to all of those caveats that I just offered there. I think they're going to let him hear it, and it's going to be pretty hectic.
I do think, generally speaking, that Kyrie is more likable from a general fan perspective than maybe he was a few years ago. I don't think there's a lot of people that would debate that.
Sure.
I'm not talking about Kyrie Irving fans. I'm talking about to the general fan that may not be a fan of his teams. It's also just fascinating because Luka has always been this player that is so, I mean, there's a lot of complaining to the officials. There's a lot of lobbying that goes on. I think sometimes that rubbed people the wrong way. He's gotten it a little bit better under control in the playoffs. But I just didn't imagine Kyrie being this at peace next to a player like that. You know, it was just hard to imagine that combination would work out in the way that it has. Yet here we are. Kyrie seems to be maybe at the most peace he's been since he was in Cleveland. It's pretty impressive.
If not before that, I mean, because he was the number one pick coming into a pretty dire team after LeBron had left. There was it feels insane, like I'm saying just Mad Libs words, but there was like a power struggle with him and Dion Waiters over whose team that was in the early stages of that, which is like, you know, kind of wild. But there may be something to be said for, you know, you get past your sort of your earlier years, you get to your early 30s, you get, you know, a decade deep in your career, and you start to kind of take stock of things. I think, I don't know that anybody, there's been a like ready-made elite level number two on a higher level than Kyrie Irving. He's absolutely perfect for what they want. It's why, you know, when the deal went down, he said, if they can get all of the off-court stuff and all of the internal, you know, machinations of this, if they can get that stuff squared away, the talent play and the on-court fit, the relationship that he could have with Luka is absolutely perfect. And there could be that harmonic convergence of we amplify one another and we elevate the team in that court. It's not like just your turn, my turn. It's the way we interact in actions and the problems that can cause for defenses. There was an example in the closeout game over Minnesota where eventually the Minnesota decides the drop defense won't work anymore. We got to blitz Luka, get the ball out of his hands. And they decide to mess with the spacing enough to where we're going to put Kyrie Irving one pass away. So that helps got to come off Kyrie. And if the help comes off Kyrie Irving, you are double teaming Luka and giving Kyrie Irving a free run downhill 4-on-3. It's going to be a layup. It's going to be a kick out to a wide open shooter. It's going to be high percentage basketball. And so like, the fit always made sense from that perspective. It was just, could you get everything else, sort of under lock and key and get everybody pulling in the same direction? They have, and it's gotten them an awful long way.
Real quick, I want to transition to Memphis before we get you out of here. We just, in the last segment, we were discussing their new hire, Noah LaRoche, who comes as a former Division III coach with this very innovative, different, creative five-out offense. There's been a lot of successful Division III coaches that have come to the NBA with new ideas, and it's worked out. Jeff Van Gundy, Stan Van Gundy, Tom Thibodeau, Greg Popovich, the list kind of goes on and on. It raises questions because a lot of people think Memphis really needs a traditional big, yet this offense that he implemented, and we don't know that the Grizzlies are going to implement this offense. In fact, it seems unlikely that they would adopt it completely. Doesn't necessarily lend itself to traditional flat-footed bigs. So I'll ask you this. Do the Grizzlies need a traditional center? Do you think Jaren would be better suited to play next to a traditional center?
I mean, all of the evidence we've seen to this point of Jaren Jackson Jr. playing the five or playing without a, like, you know, road-grading, I-box-everybody-out kind of big, it just hasn't been the highest levels that that team has reached, right? I think the thing that makes me think of, you know, you bring in a coach that has coached at a lower level and has had to get innovative to succeed is, what that tells me is that guy's pretty good at looking at what he's got and figuring out a way to make the best out of it, right? Like, it's you know, you're not picking at the top of the five-star recruiting rankings. You're figuring out, how do I make how to consistently generate high efficiency offense and successful possessions with, you know, the kind of talent that we've got available to us here at the Division III level. And I think if you take somebody who's good at that, and then the examples to that go back, like Nick Nurse, you know, coaching in Great Britain and, you know, all, you know, every minor league across the NBA. Chris Finch, you know, making his bones with Rio Grande Valley in the G League. Like, the guys who have had the opportunity, or the necessity being the mother of invention, saying, we got to figure out a way to make this work, no matter what the ingredients are in the cupboard. You got to be a chopped competitor, right? You got to figure, no matter what's in the basket, you got to cook something with it. So I think that's, you know, an idea of getting something, a fresher look, and somebody that's maybe got a little bit more of that innovation to their game. That makes a ton of sense, especially, you know, with what has the Achilles heel been for the Grizzlies the last few years? It's been half-court offense, right? It's been how do we get the most, like, we certainly have an elite pick-and-roll downhill threat in John Morant. We've got sort of a futuristic spacing big who can face up and drive in Jaren Jackson Jr. We've got this ace two-guard in Desmond Bane, who wound up playing a lot more on the ball last year. We've got these pieces, but the half-court offense still has been a little stagnant. And I think you got to the point that you asked initially, a lot of that goes back to, we're playing two traditional bigs. We're playing a non-spacing big. We're playing a flat-footed big. So I think it's all trade-offs. It's, do you think that whatever big you get to go in next to Jaren, if it is somebody who is a floor spacer, is it also somebody that helps with the rebounding issue? And then if not, are you going to be good enough offensively to live with whatever problems you have on the rebounding end? I think Oklahoma City, we mentioned them earlier, being the number one seed in the West, that was a path that they took. Like, they knew they were going to get beat up on the glass sometimes, but they felt that their five-out spacing with Chet Holmgren and the way they could open things up in the dribble drive game, like that was that calculated gamble was worth it for them. It took them a long way, 57 wins, number one seed in the West. When they got down to a team that was going to bully them a little bit and that could play, could sort of cut the floor off on them and be a little bit more of a bully in the paint, they ran into a tough matchup in Dallas. So I think that's the concern, is the trade-off that you make. Are you going to be elite enough at the thing you want to be good at to make up for the downfalls you're going to have elsewhere? So that's a decision that the front office is going to have to make there, and the coaching staff will have to make when they decide what the game plan is. But yeah, if you're not just going to get Steven Adams 2.0, which I don't even know exactly where you'd find that guy, but if you're not just going to get him, you need to imagine what life looks like with a different type of big, and this might be one way to do that.
Dan, thank you so much. I can listen to you talk hoops all day, my dude.
Oh, that's good, because I just don't stop talking. So, Drew, thank you very much for having me, man. Take care.
Yeah.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
It's time for Pitch Hit and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Give the kids in your community a chance to flex their superpowers, and they could earn a trip to the national finals of the 2025 World Series presented by Capital One. So go ahead, be the one who powers their dreams, and sign up to host the local Pitch Hit and Run event. It's a free and fun way to promote baseball, softball, and your organization. To learn more, go to pitchhitrun.com.